The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Although the word vitamins has been around for just over a century, the symptoms of vitamin deficiencies have been a blight on human health through the ages. Among them, swollen limbs, rotting gums, scaling of the skin, convulsions, suffocation, internal hemorrhaging, and a litany of other horrors. Today, essential nutrients are added to processed foods, and billions of dollars are spent on the almost entirely unregulated vitamin and supplement market. Journalist Catherine Price writes about the history, science, and beliefs surrounding chemicals manufactured and sold without any requirement to prove their safety, efficacy, or even composition. Her new book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. And Catherine Price, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So I just mentioned some of the diseases or symptoms of diseases like scurvy and rickets and beriberi. Why does the body need vitamins?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I've never heard anyone make internal hemorrhaging sound so cheerful. So that was, kind of nice there. Basically our bodies have evolved to need these 13 dietary chemicals that we know as vitamins. Which is an important clarification to make up front, is that the word vitamin is often used to refer to the much broader category of dietary supplements, which is basically like everything you see in the drugstore when you go into the supposed vitamin aisle. But these 13 substances, A, D, E, K, C, and the 8 B vitamins, our bodies do need. And what's interesting is that we may have originally been able to make some of these substances, including vitamin C, but for some reason, we've evolved to not be able to make most of these from our diet. So we need them in order to facilitate chemical reactions that keep our bodies running.
Now, there are so many foods that are fortified and enriched with vitamins. And you write about this as a convergence of two things, you know, an increase in processed food and a kind of magical thinking or belief in the power of vitamins. Can you kind of bring those two together for us?
Sure. So the first synthetic, by which I mean man-made vitamins, were created in the 1930s and 40s. And it was around the time that there also was a big increase in foods made from refined grains and a lot of processing going on. So the problem with the processing is that while it's necessary to have that kind of processing in order to have foods with long shelf lives, it also tends to destroy the vitamins and natural nutrients in that food. So that is part of the reason that fortification first started happening to the American food supply, was to make sure that these products wouldn't actually leave us in a state of deficiency. But at the same time, vitamins were enormously appealing to food marketers right from the beginning. So as you mentioned, the word was only coined in 1911, and that was actually before any vitamin had been chemically isolated. That didn't happen until thiamine in 1926. But even before then, you started to see food companies start to advertise the vitamin content of their products. And basically, it was just because, you know, vitamins, first of all, great word, fantastic marketing term. Mm-hmm. But second, if you give a vitamin to someone who actually has a severe deficiency, you actually will have miraculous results. If you give someone vitamin C who has scurvy, they'll get better. I mean, it's really pretty amazing. They are miracle drugs in that case. But, you know, what we did erroneously is to apply this idea of miracles beyond the purposes that vitamins are actually intended for and beyond the capabilities that they actually have.
Yeah, well, that was then when processed foods started being offered on the shelf. Now we have access to a wide variety of foods. But you found some research on what would happen even today if food were not enriched with synthetic vitamins. Like what?
Well, yeah, I found this fascinating. It was a 2011 paper that showed that a considerable percentage of the vitamins in the American diet actually come from these synthetic sources. And some of these things are they've been going on for so long, we don't even notice them. Like, for example, the vitamin D in milk is actually a synthetic addition. Milk does not have very much vitamin D to begin with. Or if you look at flour, most of our grain products are made with enriched flour. And when a flour is sold as enriched, it needs to have a particular combination of B vitamins, among other things. So it's very interesting to me to think that we like to think of our food supply as being so superior to everyone else in the world. But in reality, if you took away these synthetic vitamins, we would actually be at risk of nutritional deficiencies.
Mm. Well, we get back to how we play shortcuts with nutrition, as you call it, this magical thinking. And you just made me think of this with vitamin D. Many people in the Northeast at this time of year have a vitamin D deficiency. So my doctor prescribes a sort of super dose of vitamin D. So you said, you know, a little bit of vitamin C will do something about scurvy. So our thinking is a little bit will do good, so a lot will be great. So does taking a super dose of vitamins actually help us?
I would say that that's not a good idea. And it is a very interesting tendency in terms of how we think of vitamins, that since a little bit is necessary and a moderate amount is not going to cause any immediate bad things to happen to you, then we assume that if we took a lot of a vitamin, then it must be able to do fantastic things for us. And that is, I think, a dangerous way to think about it. You know, for the most part, vitamins aren't going to hurt you in the short term, with the main exception being vitamin A, which can be toxic to your liver. But over a long period of time, having high levels of vitamins can mess up other things going on in your body. Like, for example, vitamin D, if you were to take a true superdose of that for a long time, you might mess up how much calcium your body is absorbing and end up with deposits of calcium in places other than your bones, like your kidneys, where you don't want them. And the other thing about stuff like vitamin C, which is a water-soluble vitamin, so a lot of people will say, oh, it's totally safe, you just pee it out, no big deal. If you were to take really a lot of vitamin C for a long period of time, we don't really know what that would do to you. And so I think it's a much better idea to just try to stick to the doses of most vitamins that you could get in foods that naturally contain them.
I'm speaking with the journalist Catherine Price. She's author of a new book called Vitamania. It's about the history and science and oftentimes the belief, almost passionate belief, in the power of vitamins and supplements. She's done a lot of research on how they came to be added into our diet and whether they are indeed necessary. This idea that a superdose of vitamins will cure all ails, it reminds me of, you know, like, you know, those patent medicines back in the Victorian era, you know, Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup or Allen's remedy for corpulence or something. Those remind me of the claims that are made about what vitamins and supplements can do. Now, in the book, you trace the lack of regulation about vitamins and supplements to industry lobbying. When did this really begin in earnest?
Well, first off, I need to say the reason that Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup works so well and those patent medicines was often because they contain like cocaine and morphine. So they actually did
work
really pretty
well.
It
really did soothe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, almost, you know, often too effectively. But in terms of supplements, they are regulated in the United States, but they are not regulated in the way that you and I would assume and the way that many consumers would want them to be, I think, if they knew more of the details. Basically, they are, as you pointed out, not required to be tested for safety or efficacy before being sold. And that is due to a law passed in 1994 called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which was written in large part directly by industry lobbyists, which forbade the FDA from ever requiring those things before supplements were sold. And what's particularly interesting about that law is that it was passed in large part with help of the American consumers, whom the supplement industry had convinced the American public that they might lose access to vitamins like vitamin C if the FDA were allowed to have its way. And the FDA actually did not want to try to take anyone's vitamins away. They were trying at that point to regulate health claims on supplement products. But it ended up being this perfect entree for the nascent supplement industry to get a much larger foothold and get this law passed that really took a lot of powers away from the FDA in ways that affect us today.
Mm-hmm. So the FDA effectively forbidden to compel supplemental makers to test products. And basically, they are required, however, to say that if you say on the label that something is in your supplements, it should be in there. And last month, the New York Attorney General ordered Walmart, Walgreens, Target, and GNC stores in New York to pull some store brand herbal supplements off the shelves. Now, this was after DNA tests showed supplements had little or none of the herbs listed. So how do we know if a vitamin or a supplement is any good?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, unfortunately. In terms of the Attorney General report, it's an interesting situation in that it's not entirely clear that the correct tests were used for that. But it doesn't take away from the point that, as you just said, there actually are huge problems in the supplement industry about products not containing what they say they should. The last figure I heard is that the FDA was finding a rate of 70%, 70, of violations in the facilities that it inspected.
Wowie. So what kind of offenses would that be?
So in that case, it would be things like not having what it said on the label, not having the ingredients and the quantities said on the label, having other contaminants like heavy metals that weren't revealed or potential allergens, not dissolving properly, which obviously, again, getting back to our urine conversation, you want to have the supplement dissolve right, otherwise you're not going to get what's in it, and then just other labeling problems.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tell people to do if they really want to take dietary supplements, then I think that they should do their own homework. And that requires looking to a third-party organization who actually does test these things to check to see if what they have is what they say they have on the label. And, you know, one of those is ConsumerLab.com, which does a great job of pulling these things off the shelves and testing. Or you can look for a seal from USP Verified is the name of the seal, or NSF. And there's another company called LabDoor.com that just came out.
When you talk about food in America, there's often this revelation of suspicion and divisions. I mean, I know plenty of people who turn their nose up at processed foods yet swear by synthetic vitamins and supplements with what I would compare to what you call in the book a kind of quasi-religious fervor. So, in other words, people who are rejecting industrial food and big pharma, but in some ways supporting big vitamins. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is an interesting dichotomy there. You do have a lot of people who say, oh, I would never eat processed foods, but I take 30 supplements every morning. And that's interesting to me because in terms of the vitamin supplements, again, those 13 vitamins, those are going to be synthetic if they're in the pill and they're synthetic in food. And honestly, it doesn't matter that much for most vitamins if it's synthetic or naturally occurring. What's more important is the context. In other words, if you have a food that naturally contains a vitamin, like an orange and vitamin C, it's got a lot of other beneficial things in it that would not be replaced in a multivitamin. But it is kind of funny to me that we do have this kind of crunchy, all-natural feeling when it comes to dietary supplements and vitamins. And that is, I think, an erroneous perception to have because it actually is. It's a huge business. I mean, the latest estimates are $36 billion a year for dietary supplements. It's not like someone just growing herbs in their backyard.
Mm. Did you take any supplements before doing your research for this book?
I don't know. I'm not that into supplements. I try my best to eat a healthy diet. But I do think there's situations where supplements can be beneficial in terms of vitamins. I think it's impossible to give a blanket response to the question of whether or not we should be taking vitamins because it really depends on what else you're eating and whether or not you have an underlying medical condition that might require you to have extra.
Well, Catherine Price, a fascinating book. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Catherine Price, she's a journalist whose writing and multimedia work has appeared in several publications from Best American Science Writing to The Washington Post. You can find much more on her book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection, including that list of sites that she mentioned that can help you determine whether you're taking the right kinds of vitamins. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. There's a lot of misinformation out there when it comes to vitamins and supplements. The same can be said of vaccines. And with new measles outbreaks being discovered each week, parents who choose not to vaccinate their kids are being criticized. Coming up, a reporter goes a step further, placing the blame squarely on moms. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New measles cases in the U.S. continue to make headlines, the latest involving an outbreak linked to a Las Vegas casino just this weekend. Parents who decide to delay or forgo the MMR, or measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, are being blamed for the spread of the disease. In an article for Slate, Ruth Graham goes one step further, saying it's not parents who are to blame. It's moms. Ruth Graham is a New Hampshire-based freelance journalist and a regular contributor to Slate. And Ruth, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
So it's a pretty hot topic, and you're pretty much poking the bear here by blaming mothers. How are people reacting?
It is. Well, it's definitely an uncomfortable question. It's uncomfortable for me, particularly as a woman. And I would say, you know, there's been a positive, you know, I've definitely had positive reactions. The negative reactions have been, well, it's rude, it's uncomfortable, it's blaming moms for something that is maybe a more complicated issue. But no one's really said that it's not their fault or that they're not the ones driving these decisions. So I don't know. I think I might be onto something.
Well, and you do back it up with some research, plenty of it, that found that women do indeed make the vast majority of healthcare decisions for their families. But what do studies show about where they're getting their information to inform these decisions?
Well, that's the interesting thing. So it's pretty obvious, I think, and it is backed up by research, that moms make the overwhelming majority of decisions about healthcare. But the more interesting research to me is that they're getting their information more from anecdotal information from the web. So there was a study last year that said women are 30% likelier to rely on sort of anecdotal Googling. And then a study from 2011, which is even more directly applicable to this issue, which is that for vaccine information specifically, women are likelier than men to trust magazine stories, to trust television, to trust stories from their friends. And really most shocking to me, they're more likely to place trust in celebrities, which, you know, when I hear that, I immediately think of Jenny McCarthy.
Right,
and get a little depressed.
Celebrity voices in this debate.
Exactly.
So faith in anecdotal evidence when it comes to not vaccinating, why do you think the pendulum does not swing the other way? In other words, why not trust anecdotal information that says vaccination is good?
Well, that's the disturbing thing, because obviously there's much more of that anecdotal evidence out there in the world. And when researchers have tried to shift their tactics and present more of this anecdotal information, this is research in its early stages, but there isn't evidence so far that that really works. And it's disturbing. But that research is sort of in its infancy. So we'll see.
Ruth, is this a bigger issue? I mean, a fundamental distrust of science, or maybe the way it's presented, or finding the right mouthpiece?
I think that's a big part of it. And there is this whole historical element here where women's stories about their own health, their claims about their own symptoms have been discounted by a lot of the mainstream medical establishment for, you know, decades, probably, you know, going back much farther than that. So if you think about women with chronic fatigue syndrome, with mental illnesses, and there's a variety of ways in which women's stories about their own health have not been taken seriously by the medical establishment. I think that's a big part of this. Even with autism specifically, which obviously looms very large over the vaccine debate, researchers spent decades focusing on this idea of refrigerator mothers, which are insufficiently loving mothers, causing autism. That's now been totally discredited. But if you think about that kind of lurking in the back of this conversation, you can understand why some of these mothers specifically might be a little wary of just trusting this information that's coming down from on high from their doctors.
So plenty of reasons to disbelieve doctors or,
absolutely,
let's say, the medical establishment. Mm-hmm. But are we on a slippery slope here when we're talking about women as – is there a risk of saying women are more likely to be anti-science?
I think there is. And I think – I mean, that to me is the most uncomfortable part of asking this question. And I think one thing that's really important to note is that the majority of mothers – do trust their doctors on these questions. Women place more trust in their doctors than they do in celebrities and magazine articles. So we're really talking about a subset of parents here. And some of the loudest voices in the vaccine debate have been men. So Andrew Wakefield, the author of this now completely discredited 1998 study, exactly, was a man. And there are certainly fathers involved in this debate. So we're talking about a subset of women, and we're not talking about the entirety of the vaccine debate.
So to reframe this story or narrative, narrative about vaccines, whether they're good or bad, what's the answer? You change who it's directed to or how it is presented?
Well, I think what I was trying to argue in the story is that maybe recognizing who the information needs to be directed to might involve changing the way that we're telling those stories or presenting that information. So again, you know, the overwhelming majority of parents do vaccinate their kids. But if we're trying to sort of capture that last percentage of holdouts, recognizing that maybe more of them are women, that we need to be speaking to women, it would be nice if we could just present the sort of straightforward scientific information, but that's obviously not resonating with everyone. So if people respond to scientific information in different ways, maybe we need to be presenting that in different ways. So if that's just a change in tone, if it's celebrity spokespeople speaking up for vaccines, if it is presenting, you know, anecdotal information in a different way that we haven't tried yet, I think it's important to know who we're speaking to when we're talking about sort of closing that final gap.
Ruth Graham, New Hampshire-based freelance journalist and a regular contributor to Slate. That's where we found her article, Don't Blame Parents for Vaccine Resistance. Ruth, thank you.
Thank you.
Now you'll find a link to read her article at our website. That's wordofmouthradio.org.
Halitosis is a real everyday problem. By far its most common cause is fermentation of proteins that are present in everybody's mouth all the time. The trouble is you could have halitosis and never know it, and even your best friend won't tell you.
Sound there from a 1952 commercial for Listerine, which, as you can hear, is largely focused on halitosis, the medical term for bad breath. But Listerine was not created to fight halitosis. That particular use was dreamt up by who else? Advertisers. Sarah Zhang is a staff writer at Gizmodo, where she wrote about the origins of Listerine as mouthwash. And Sarah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, hello. Thank you for having me.
What was Listerine originally marketed for and when?
Right. So Listerine was actually invented in 1879 by a doctor. So this is around the time in which we were just starting to understand germ theory. And, you know, surgeons were seeing that if they disinfected wounds, they were less likely to get infections in patients. So, you know, Listerine is basically alcohol-based, and it basically kills all the bacteria it touches. So for the first few decades, you know, in which Listerine existed, it was actually only available to doctors to use in surgery. And then in 1914, the company that owned Listerine, which was called Lambert Pharmacol Company at the time, decided that they, you know, might have a wider audience for Listerine. So if you look at early ads, they actually, you know, we think of Listerine now as synonymous with mouthwash, but actually the early ads kind of sell it for all sorts of purposes. It's kind of as a general disinfectant for using cuts and scrapes, for using dandruff. I even found an ad for using it as a douche fluid. So it was really all over the place. But it wasn't really until they found the idea of halitosis that it became the mouthwash that we know today.
They found the idea of halitosis? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this is kind of an interesting story. And so Gerald Lambert, who owned the company, had tells a story in which he was in this brainstorming session with a chemist in the company, and they were just kind of going over, like, you know, what can we sell Listerine for? And the chemist just kind of has this clipping from a British medical journal, and he says, oh, you know, it says something about halitosis, and Gerald describes it almost as like a light bulb going up over his head, and it's like, oh, halitosis, you know, this is like a medical term. And it kind of gives this authoritative air to something that we have experienced, but didn't really realize was pathological. So Listerine sort of starts this new advertising campaign where they start preying on social fears of bad breath.
So that sounds like such an advertiser's goldmine, identifying something that is a deficiency in human beings or makes something wrong with them.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when you look at like at the advertisement we heard earlier in the segment, basically all these ads were saying, you know, bad breath is something that exists and now it has a medical term for it. And it's also something that people are too polite to tell you. So you'll see these ads that say, oh, you know, only your children might tell you because adults are too polite to tell you. Or you'll see ads where it's like one woman sitting sadly by a side, another couple being happy. And it's the idea that you're being ostracized or you're being held back because you had bad breath. But no one is going to tell you except for this ad. And look, we have the solution for it, which is mouthwash.
Well, let's hear just another Listerine jingle.
He said that she said that he had halitosis. She said that he said it's true of some girls too. He said that she said the answer was simple. Here's what she said to do. Try Listerine, buy Listerine, keep breath fresh and clean with Listerine.
So everybody's whispering about your bad breath. Listerine is now synonymous with mouthwash, and there have been studies on its efficacy in fighting gingivitis and plaque. But more recently, there's the idea that antibacterial mouthwash is being examined more closely. What for and how?
Yeah, that's right. So I think, you know, Listerine kind of comes out of what you might think of as like our first revolution for understanding microbes, which is that there are microbes out there everywhere and they are bad for you and they can cause disease. So I think now we're kind of entering like a second revolution in which we're understanding there are microbes out there everywhere inside you, especially inside your gut, and not all of them are bad. Some of them might even be good for you. And so just like how there are microbes in your gut, and, you know, taking antibiotics that kills all of them can sometimes cause problems. Perhaps maybe we actually have a community of microbes in our mouth as well. Perhaps if we have mouthwash that just kills them all the time, maybe that's not great for us either. And so, you know, there's sort of some interesting line of research that says, instead of killing everything, maybe we can try to hack the mouth microbiome in ways that are slightly more specific. So, for example, there's this one bacteria called Streptococcus salivaris K12, and it's kind of since shown that it may actually fight halitosis. So what researchers have done is basically had volunteers suck on lozenges that have been laced with this bacteria, and they've seen that, you know, after a few days, the volunteers had better breath, and it may be because they had an extra bacteria in their mouth rather than because they had no bacteria in their mouth.
Sarah Zhang, thank you so much for filling us in on the true origins of Listerine.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sarah Zhang, she's a staff writer at Gizmodo. You can learn more about the origins of Listerine at wordofmouthradio.org. As we just heard, in the case of Listerine, 20th century advertisers have had a profound effect on public conception of germs and purity and cleanliness. Not that long ago, many people took a bath only once a week. Now many Americans shower every day. Olga Kazan took a look at global statistics on showering to see how geography and culture play into hygiene habits. And she joins us now to explain what she found. Olga, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Great to be here.
Now, I think of the U.S. as a country fairly obsessed with cleanliness. How do we stack up compared to other countries when it comes to showering?
We're actually probably not the most frequent showers in the world. It looks like, at least from the poll that I looked at from Euromonitor, that some of the Latin American countries like Colombia, Brazil, and Mexico shower more frequently than us. And so do some Middle Eastern countries and places like Indonesia and Australia.
So do you attribute that to heat or culture or what?
You know, I'm not entirely sure because it doesn't really the heat explanation doesn't totally fit all of the countries, because you have Spain. According to this poll, people in Spain shower about as frequently as we do. People in Turkey shower slightly less frequently. And India is about on par with the U.S. And those are all places that are, you know, can be pretty balmy. So the heat explanation isn't really kind of the perfect answer, you know, and maybe it's not so much about cleanliness as it is about just like it's hot and you want to kind of take a dip.
In which countries do they shower the least?
So it actually looks like Japan, the UK, and China from the Euromonitor poll. And then it looks like also Russia and Sweden on this other poll that I looked at by a company called SCA.
Now, when you're looking at this, you found that in the early 20th century, Americans really ramped up in showering. Why was that at that time?
Well, so, I mean, you had a lot of companies kind of coming forward and trying to, you know, sell soap for different and new purposes. So, you know, where originally you might only sell soap for washing clothes, suddenly you want people to buy soap to wash themselves. And of course, once you have that, you want them to use it frequently. So these companies, but also doctors at the time and maybe some influencers like Dale Carnegie started sort of promoting this idea that as people were working in closer quarters and moving into offices, offices rather than, you know, working on the farm, that they should be clean and smell really nice all the time so that they can be, you know, pleasant for their coworkers.
We seem to be entering this age, you know, the no poo, the anti-shampoo movement, where clean doesn't always equal healthy. Do you think we may see a drop in showering habits in the future?
I really think that we will, just based on how things are going. I mean, the movement of, I think it kind of started with women shampooing their hair less frequently, and that started a few years ago as women began to realize that, you know, if I go a few days without shampooing, at first my hair gets really gross, but then, you know, it actually improves. And I know, you know, some of my female friends said, you know, I bit the bullet and I went, you know, a week without shampooing my hair. But then after that week was over, you know, my hair was completely fine, and now it looks normal and healthy all the time, and I almost never have to shampoo it, which is actually, you know, by some definitions, like, that's how frequently shampoo should be used anyway, is just, you know, once or twice a week. And so I think that, you know, some people are experimenting with doing the same thing with showering, maybe not quite on the same scale, but alternating days or skipping days, and it's finding that their skin is less dry or that they have less eczema. And so for some people, it really does work, and it's something that they want to try.
Olga Kazan, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Olga Kazan, she's staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers health. And you can check out her article, complete with a lot of interesting graphs on global showering statistics. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, the story of a singular New Hampshire athlete who averages 400 miles of biking and running each week. The life and times of an ultra marathoner, when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We've been talking today about some of the myths and industries that influence common perceptions and pursuits of good health. We turn now to the individual and extreme quest of athletic excellence. Endurance athletes are driven to go to lengths that those of us who casually work out can barely imagine. NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown brings us the story of one such man who's made endurance a way of life.
I usually spend the first hour of the day just sitting here drinking coffee, like just watching TV, not doing anything.
Cale Poland is 32 years old and lives in Laconia. He's skinny but broad-shouldered. He's got a shaved head and often sports a beard, though right now it's just a little soul patch. This time of day, early morning, is about the only time you can catch him at rest.
So on the way to work, I'm driving into town, and I see him running on the sidewalk carrying bags of groceries, just running.
I hear this scuffing sound and turn around and look, and there's this individual with bald head and a big bushy beard running up the hill, towing this big tire with a chain. And as he went by, I just shook my head and said, "You're an animal."
Cale does ultramarathons. The term ultra, in case you've somehow missed this particular brand of crazy, at first meant any running race longer than a marathon. But it now encompasses a whole lot of really long races of every sort, including triathlons. Think of the Ironman. It's a 2.5-mile swim, a 112-mile bike ride, and a marathon. It takes between 8 and 17 hours.
For a lot of people, the Ironman is the pinnacle of the sport.
Not for Cale Poland. His ultra-distance resume reads like a catalog of bad ideas. He's done many 50-mile running races, of course, also a few double Ironman races, even triple and quintuple Ironman distance events. But in 2012, he was the 7th American ever to complete what he calls a DECA. That's 10 times the distance of an Ironman.
You know, you kind of get, like, written into the books, the obscure history books of ultra-distance tri.
There are two ways of doing a race like this. One is you do an Ironman every day. When you finish, you go to bed and you wake up the next day to do another, 10 days in a row. But what Cale did is called a continuous DECA triathlon, where each leg is simply 10 times as long as a normal Ironman, and after the starting pistol, the clock never stops. That's a 24-mile swim, a 1,120-mile bike ride, and a 262-mile run.
It's like, you know, it's longer than the English Channel. You're cycling from Maine to the Carolinas, maybe. And then you're swimming, or running rather, to, you know, another couple states.
There are lots of ultra runners out there. Every year, in fact, there are more. Since 2004, the number of ultra distance running races in North America has quadrupled. But in this blossoming niche, Cale is kind of a different breed. For one, his training is just built into his life. Here's his routine. A few times a week, he's up at 5:15 in the morning to teach a spin class at the local athletic club. Next, he heads to Gunstock, 8 miles away, where he manages the cross-country center and coaches the ski team. By the way, he doesn't drive a car. He either runs or bikes. Just Cale's baseline level of activity is pretty boggling. Before he even gets to going for a run just to go for a run, Cale can clock somewhere between 70 and 120 miles a week. Once you add in just plain old exercising, he's hoping to average around 400 miles a week.
This little hill here, like, you don't even think of it as one until you get on a bike.
Yeah.
Kind of sneaks up on you.
The day I tagged along, he rode his bike to work. He hit the road at around 6 a.m. wearing a pair of ratty old wind pants and a jacket his employer had given him. He had two bags slung over his shoulders. This is another thing that sets him apart. He simply doesn't buy into the gear fetishism that permeates so many endurance sports. The bike he rides in the winter is this janky, noisy thing, maybe 20 years old. He's got it retrofitted to be a single speed, even though it's not designed to be one. It wasn't working very well.
Uh-oh. This is getting bad. I'm not worried. Whatever. I do have running shoes. I do have running shoes. Yep, there's that.
About 15 minutes into the ride, the chain falls off and we're off the bikes on the side of the road in the dark. I dig around in the oversized satchel that he's got slung over his shoulder and pull out a folding bike tool.
This is so stupid.
Cale rides in the snow, wind, rain, cold. He shakes off offers for rides home. Once, at the end of the day, he went to start his return commute and found he had a flat tire. But it was so cold, he just couldn't gather the will to change it. So he rode the 8 miles home on a flat tire. Miles Chase, Cale's boss at a bike shop in town, told me Cale once went to do a triathlon in Maine. He tried to bike there, but he got another flat. He called a friend to ask for a ride, but no dice.
He has his pack on. He has all his gear in his... on him, so he puts on his run shoes and he runs the last 30 miles.
30 miles, pushing his bike, wearing a backpack. Cale says it took around 4 or 5 hours.
And he raced and did really well. But that's the life of Cale.
I like being fit. And I also know that if I had a car, I would not be able to do any events that I do because I know what choices I would make.
He says more than anything, he just wants to be tough. He says he cares about other things too, like saving money and the environment, but really, it's all about being tough. What's perhaps most astonishing about Cale is not the races he does or this sort of anytime, anywhere training philosophy or even the decision to use all of his gear until it's absolutely useless. It's that he can do all of this and still lead a pretty normal life with friends and a wife.
When I see him when he comes home from work, I'm not thinking, oh, this is my remarkable husband coming home.
This is Cale's wife, Nicole Poland. They were married last spring.
He's a regular guy who likes to do non-regular activities.
She doesn't do ultramarathons. She does run, but it doesn't seem to be any sort of centerpiece to her lifestyle. So as a couple, they have to find compromises.
We worked out a system, actually, I think it was last summer, where if we're going to go closer to the same pace and he doesn't have to go ahead and stop and wait for me, he can put some heavy weight in his backpack to slow him down a little bit.
She says Cale fits most of his exercise into a routine that works with their life together, but I suspect that's only part of what makes their relationship work. She's remarkably tolerant. For instance, in their engagement photos, Cale had this gigantic beard. No mustache, no sideburns, just a huge, black, wiry beard. He says his goal was for it to be bushy enough to see even when his back was turned.
I look back on it now and I think, why didn't I say that needs to go? But then to tell somebody you need to get that off of your face when he seemed to like it so much, I just didn't feel like that was really something for me to say or demand.
But despite her tolerance, this says something about Kale, too. Something that a lot of people say. Athletes are often type A personalities. It's all about them, all about their race, all about their workout, their nutrition, their recovery. But not so much Kale.
I've been in the athletic community long enough to realize that most people that do these events are strange people. Sometimes very strange people.
Here again is Kale's boss.
And that's what's so strange about Kale is he's not a strange person. He has his quirks and he does some pretty weird things and his lifestyle's strange. But you could have a conversation with him like any other person and you would not realize his athletic ability or what he's accomplished.
Kale's races go for days. That Deca Ironman he finished took 12 days. And remember, this is continuous. Any time that he slept, which was only for a few hours a night, the clock was still running. And just in case that sounds slightly appealing to you, the swim was in a pool, the bike ride was on a 1 kilometer course that takes 2 minutes or so to complete, and the run was on a similarly tiny loop, all within one city park in Monterrey, Mexico.
Oh, It was a horrible. I didn't actually enjoy the DECA, I don't think, for almost any of it. I was sick during the swim, and I definitely was sick during the run. The bike, I don't know. I may have enjoyed the bike the most of anything. The first few days are fine on the bike. You know, I know what a couple days feels like on the bike. 400, 500, 600 miles, I know what that feels like. But when you start hitting 500 miles, and you wake up in the morning after like a 2 hour sleep and you go, I have to spend the next 20 hours on the bike. And then you wake up the next day and you go, I need to spend the next 20 hours on a bike. And then you wake up the next day. It's like a nightmare that doesn't end.
The question that anyone who doesn't do races like this inevitably asks is why? Why do it?
I wouldn't say that I'm not like a masochist or anything.
Right.
I mean, how do you say it without being cliche? Oh, I want to find my limits and push them. It's not that.
He tells this story of attempting his first 100-mile running race, which he didn't finish. He says he got to run for a little while with the guy who eventually won a 200-mile race going on at the same time on the same course.
He was like moaning, crying. And he was on his last lap. It was, and it was super inspiring. And I'm like, wow, that dude is awesome. I want to be just like him.
So I want to derail you here for a second.
Yeah, sure.
Because I think you probably know this, but like most people, if they had gone for a hike with this guy who was like moaning and yeah. and they would say like, there's no f-ing way that I'm doing that race ever.
Yeah.
There's no way I'm doing it. And like, what is wrong with these people? But so somehow for you, that's like hugely appealing.
Yeah.
Can you explain that? Is it possible to explain that?
The distance, you can't race. So I like the idea of the journey. I think that's it. You know, the journey. It's all about just dealing with what you have. You don't have any responsibilities. You have your only focus is one thing. And that's just moving forward.
The end of the DECA is on YouTube. There are maybe around a dozen people gathered around a finishing line tape festooned with sponsors' logos. He comes jogging up, carrying an American flag, wearing only spandex shorts and his racing bib, a hat, and sunglasses. But he stops just shy of breaking through. He rubs the back of his neck and looks around, unsure of what's next. Race workers lower the finish line so he can step over and start hugging people. Someone jokes that he missed a lap. His dad pours a bit of beer over his hat and the crowd laughs. Within 2 minutes, the celebration is done, and Kale says, I don't really know what to do. There's no forward left, And for a few minutes, he just turns circles, shaking hands and hugging the people who are there to cheer for him. Cale doesn't hate every race that he does. He enjoys most of them. The race that I suspect he's most proud of and liked best was last year. It was called the Peak 500, a 500-mile running race in Vermont. It was 50 laps of a 10-mile course that went up and over a mountain every time. Cale calculates the elevation change was equivalent to going up and down Mount Everest 4.5 times. It involves sections that are off-trail, a section of hiking up a stream, and brutally steep climbs and descents. So he came prepared.
Cheez-Its, cheese balls, Twizzlers, those Starbucks drinks, those are actually unbelievable.
The run took 8 days. 5 people started, and he and one other were the only ones to finish. A friend had given him 2 pairs of fancy ultra-running shoes to race in, but when that friend came to visit, that wasn't what Cale had on his feet.
And he looked at the shoes that I was wearing, and he's like, "What are those?" And I'm like, "Walmart shoes." Like, I had my wife bring them on when she was coming to visit.
By the end of the race, he could only fit into size 13 shoes, fully 2 sizes bigger than what he usually wears. And he was starting to hallucinate.
I was kind of seeing like letters on rocks, which were obviously not there. Nobody's taking marker on every single rock. And it was almost like I would look down and they would just be there. And I'd look away, they're not there.
The next lap, his last lap, the hallucinations got worse.
Every time I looked into the woods, there was some form of, I called him a mannequin because it was like a human. You know, it wasn't doing anything. It was just stationary. It wouldn't do anything. Some of them were crouching. Some of them were standing. But they were all kind of just staring, like, at me. And that was really unnerving. So it was kind of like a little bit of a nightmare.
That last lap, he just kept his eyes fixed on the ground.
I could deal with letters, but I couldn't deal with the mannequins because that was just too freaky for me. So I was like, okay, I can appreciate an E. An E is cool. But like this ghost thing over here, I'm all set.
Cale finished. He won, actually. The other guy was only 3 hours or so behind him, which is basically winning by a nose in a race this long. His big move was sleeping only an hour or so on the last night, which is maybe where the hallucinations came from. He was only the 4th person ever to finish this event. Cale's sense of needing to move forward was the closest I think I got to a real explanation of where his drive to do these races comes from. At the time, I told him he did a good job of explaining that motivation, but I realized later it was probably only a good explanation to someone like me, someone who likes exercising. Maybe to an extent that some people find unnerving. One thing that's clear is Cale's a worker. I think he needs to feel like he's accomplishing something every day. I think that explains why he always has 3 or 4 jobs and why he worked 40-hour weeks in retail while he was in college. And it's also clear that he just plain likes his sports and likes being outside. But I think there's also something Cale didn't quite acknowledge. And this is the reason why I think I found his explanation satisfactory, but others might not. For many athletes, there's a point at which exercise becomes a tick, a tingle that you have to rub until it goes away. If it were gambling or liquor, we would call it a vice, but it's good for you. Exercise can be addictive, and I think Cale is hooked. Here's his wife.
You can tell the difference between Cale with exercise and Cale without exercise.
She says when he hasn't exercised, he gets quiet and tense. After he gets back, he seems calmer and evened out.
I think he just might hold it all inside, and then he just needs to let it out, and that's his way of doing it.
Cale had to go to the hospital after the Peak 500 because the blisters on his feet were so bad. But that's all just sort of part of the process. And it's a process he's ready to go through again. The same organizer is putting on another absurdly long running race this year. This one is 888 kilometers. He's also got a couple of long-distance speed records he's going to try to break, one biking and one hiking. He doesn't want to announce those attempts until a week or two before, for fear that some other crazy person will try to steal his thunder. But really, these races are just jabs to get him out the door. It's the getting out the door that he's shooting for. Cale says years ago, a friend of his really articulated this.
And he put it the best. He's like, you know what, Cale? I have never gone for a run, came back and regretted it. You know, like, that doesn't happen. You don't finish and go, oh, I wish I didn't do that. You always feel better.
Of course, that's assuming your feet haven't swelled two sizes. He says he's still got those size 13 Walmart shoes. He's saving them for this summer. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
We are so grateful for your listening time today, and there's so much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. If you missed any of the show today, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.